All right, let's dive into another case, shall we? This one should really resonate, especially for those of you dealing with or likely to deal with bankruptcy issues, you know, in your legal practice. Imagine this. You're hit with a massive lawsuit, millions of dollars, accusations flying around about, well, shady dealings before a company went belly up. Yeah. Sounds like a legal thriller, right? But then, to make matters worse, imagine being flat out denied a jury trial.
Yeah, no, I mean, talk about adding insult to injury, right?
Exactly. And that's exactly what went down in the case of Grand Financiera versus Nordberg.
Yeah.
Supreme Court weighed in on this one, and it's, well, it's a decision you'll want to have in your legal arsenal.
Absolutely. It's a real clash of titans, you know. Bankruptcy law going head-to-head with the Seventh Amendment, that right to a jury trial. It wasn't a clear-cut decision either, 5-4 split. Some really strong opinions on both sides. Definitely makes it all the more fascinating to break down.
Okay, so rewind the clock, set the scene for us, this whole saga. Where does it all begin?
1983, and we're talking about Chase and Sanborn. Yeah, the coffee folks, they file for bankruptcy.
Chase and Sanborn. Wow, okay.
Right. So enter the bankruptcy trustee, Nordberg. He starts sniffing around, thinks something's fishy, and decides to go after Grand Financiera and MedEx. We're talking a hefty sum, $1.7 million, alleging they received fraudulent transfers from Chase and Sanborn before, you know, the bankruptcy hit.
Okay, so like trying to hide assets before things went south?
Essentially, yeah. But here's where it gets even more, let's say intriguing.
Laid on me.
Grand Financiera and MedEx, they never actually filed any claims in the bankruptcy case themselves. They were, for all intents and purposes, outsiders.
Oh, so they're being dragged into this whole mess without even being part of the original bankruptcy proceedings.
Right, and that really throws a wrench into the whole jury trial question.
Makes sense. Okay, so we've got Nordberg going after these companies, lower courts. They're saying, nope, no jury for you. Labeling this whole thing a core bankruptcy proceeding.
Which in their view meant no jury trial necessary, like it was just a given.
But I'm guessing Grand Financiera and MedEx, they weren't too keen on that idea.
Not one bit. They appealed, fought their way up to the highest court in the land, the Supreme Court.
Talk about a legal showdown, this is big. So what was the central question, like the heart of the matter for the Supreme Court?
Okay, so it boils down to this. Does that Seventh Amendment right to a jury trial, does it hold up even in a bankruptcy case? Especially when you're talking about someone who, you know, hasn't filed a claim in the case itself, an outsider like Grand Financiera and MedEx. It's about power, right? Congress makes the laws, but the Constitution, well, that's supposed to protect those individual rights.
Yeah, like who trumps who in this situation. So how'd the Supreme Court go about untangling this whole constitutional knot? What was their approach?
They had a two-part test, a classic move for them when they're trying to figure out, you know, the scope of a right like this.
Okay, break it down for us. Two-part test. Let's hear it.
First, they went all the way back. Time travel to 18th century England. The question, would a case like this involving these fraudulent transfers, would it have even gone before a jury back then?
Oh, I see. So trying to get into the minds of the framers, like what was their intention?
Precisely. And what they found was pretty significant. Turns out, fraudulent conveyance cases, these were considered legal matters, not equitable ones. And historically, legal matters meant juries. So point one for Grand Financiera and MedEx there.
Interesting. Okay, so they passed the first part of the test. What about part two? What did the Supreme Court look at there?
Part two zeroes in on the remedy. What were Grand Financiera and MedEx actually seeking? Remember, they wanted money, and that, well, that's a classic legal remedy. It's not an equitable remedy, like an injunction or something like that.
Right, so their desired outcome further strengthens their argument for a jury trial.
Exactly. They're checking off the boxes.
Now, I remember in our prep for this deep dive, we talked about this public rights exception. Can you remind us what's that all about?
Yes. Good catch. The public rights exception, it's basically a way for Congress to say, okay, even if this type of case historically would have gone before a jury, we're carving out a specific exception here.
So like a special circumstance where a jury trial isn't required?
Right. You see this in disputes involving government agencies. Think like battling the IRS over a tax bill.
So in those very specific situations, it's like Congress is saying, hey, a judge can handle this one. No need for a jury to get involved.
Yeah, precisely. But here's the key. Grand Financiera, it didn't fit that mold. It wasn't a government agency situation. This was a dispute between private parties. So the Supreme Court, they said, look, just because Congress sets up bankruptcy courts doesn't mean they can just sidestep the Seventh Amendment.
Oh, interesting. So they can't just relabel a historically legal claim as equitable and make the jury disappear?
Exactly. No rewriting history allowed.
Okay, so we've got the historical context, the remedy sought, this whole public rights exception thing. Seems like a lot is pointing towards a jury trial for Grand Financiera, but I know this wasn't a unanimous decision.
Right. It was a close one, 5-4 split, and believe me, the justices, well, they didn't hold back. Some pretty strong opinions flying around.
Okay, so let's unpack that a bit. What were the main arguments, you know, from both sides? What were the justices really grappling with here?
So Justice Brennan, he wrote the majority opinion, really hammered home this idea that jury trials, they're a cornerstone of our legal system. You can't just erase that, right? Because it's, you know, convenient or efficient.
So like a firm stance for the Seventh Amendment.
Absolutely. No messing around with that, right? But even among the justices who agreed, there were some, well, different shades of opinion.
Oh, how so?
Well, Justice Scalia, he agreed with the outcome, you know, jury trial for Grand Financiera, but he wrote a separate concurring opinion. He was a bit wary, you know, of that public rights exception. Like, hey, let's not stretch this thing too far. Keep it within its lane.
So even among those who ruled in favor of Grand Financiera, some lingering concerns, huh? What about the dissent? What were their main arguments against a jury trial in this case?
The dissent, you had Justices White and Blackmun writing those opinions, and for them, it all boiled down to practicality. Like, bankruptcy courts with judges who specialize in this area, they're already well equipped to handle this. Why add the jury into the mix?
So their argument was more about efficiency, keeping the bankruptcy process streamlined.
Exactly. Less complications, less moving parts.
Okay, so a real clash of philosophies here. But ultimately, drumroll please, what was the Supreme Court's final verdict?
The gavel came down in favor of Grand Financiera. Seventh Amendment prevails. Even in a bankruptcy case, even with that core proceeding label, they said, these defendants, they deserve a jury trial.
A win for Grand Financiera. And I guess you could say a win for the Seventh Amendment?
Definitely a significant ruling. But the story doesn't end there.
Right, because now we've got to, you know, look beyond this specific case. What are the wider implications? What does this all really mean in the grand scheme of things?
This case, it sends a clear message. Congress, they can't just redefine what gets a jury trial whenever it suits them. The Constitution, well, that's the trump card.
So it's a check on their power. Congress can't just ignore those fundamental rights.
You got it. Plus, for those bankruptcy trustees out there, this decision, it's a bit of a wake-up call. They can't just assume they can bypass a jury, especially when you're dealing with a defendant who hasn't filed a claim in the bankruptcy case, like in Grand Financiera.
So it adds a level of, well, I guess, strategic complexity to their work.
For sure. But hey, it's all in the name of fairness and upholding those constitutional rights.
And that's something all lawyers, you know, should appreciate, regardless of their area of practice. So Grand Financiera, it's not just a bankruptcy case, right? It's a case about power, about balancing those individual rights with the need for, well, a functional legal system.
Absolutely. It reminds us that the law is, well, it's more than just rules on a page. It's about navigating those complexities, weighing those competing interests.
Right. Like, where do we draw the line? When does efficiency outweigh those individual rights? Grand Financiera, it forces us to, well, to really grapple with that question.
No easy answers, for sure. And that's what makes this case so fascinating. It highlights this tension between efficiency and those fundamental rights, a tension we see pop up all over the law, right? As our legal system evolves, it's a constant balancing act.
And a reminder that the law, well, it's not static. It's constantly adapting, being challenged, and, well, cases like Grand Financiera. They're pushing those boundaries, shaping the legal landscape.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Grand Financiera, it's a reminder that these cases, they have a ripple effect, impacting how future cases are decided, how laws are interpreted.
It's like, you know, each case adds another layer to this complex tapestry that is our legal system.
Exactly. And that's why staying informed is so crucial. Understanding the historical context of these decisions, you know, engaging in these conversations about those fundamental rights, that balance between efficiency and individual liberties, it matters, right? Mm. For all of us, lawyers, and, well, frankly, everyone navigating this legal system.
Well said, well said. So we've covered a lot of ground here, but we're not done yet. There's another fascinating layer to Grand Financiera that we're going to, well, really dive into in part two of this deep dive. Remember that public rights exception we talked about?
Oh, yeah, that one's a doozy.
Well, Grand Financiera, it actually provides some really insightful guidance on the limits of that exception. So stay tuned for part two, where we'll unpack all that and more. Welcome back. Now, thinking about the trustee in this case, Nordberg, didn't this decision, I mean, doesn't it kind of make their job a bit trickier? I mean, it's not as simple as just filing a lawsuit and letting the judge decide.
Yeah, no doubt it definitely adds another layer, right? They can't just assume they can bypass a jury, especially when, you're dealing with a defendant like Grand Financiera, someone who hasn't filed a claim in the bankruptcy case. That Seventh Amendment right, it really comes into play.
So it's about strategy now. They have to think about that jury possibility right from the get-go.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's about protecting those rights, even in, a specialized area like bankruptcy.
Due process, right. Everyone deserves their day in court, even when things get, well, messy like in a bankruptcy case.
Exactly.
Now, I know the dissenters in this case, they had a different view, didn't they? They were more focused on the practical side of things.
Right. Justices White and Blackmun, they really felt that bankruptcy courts, they were already well equipped to handle these types of disputes. They had specialized judges, familiar with the ins and outs of bankruptcy law. Why bring a jury into it? Complicate things.
So they saw it as adding unnecessary complexity to an already intricate process.
Exactly. Bankruptcy proceedings, they can be a real labyrinth of financial transactions and legal maneuvering. The dissenters, they worried that juries would just, get bogged down, slow things
But
down.
the majority, they pushed back on that, right? They weren't swayed by those efficiency arguments.
Right. For them, that Seventh Amendment right, it was paramount. Sure, efficiency is important, but it can't overshadow that fundamental right, especially when you're talking about fraudulent conveyance. That's a claim that's been, well, a part of our legal system for centuries.
So it's like, where do we draw the line? Efficiency versus individual rights? It's a tough call. And Grand Financiera, well, it really puts that dilemma front and center.
It forces us to confront those hard choices, those trade-offs. And that's what makes this case, well, so compelling. It's not just about bankruptcy. It's about those bigger questions, those enduring tensions in our legal system.
It's about the Constitution, the rule of Congress, the rights of individuals. It's it's a lot to unpack.
And it reminds us that, the law, it's not static. It's a living thing, always evolving. And cases like Grand Financiera, they keep pushing those boundaries.
So it's not just a historical footnote, it's a case that continues to shape how we think about the law, how we approach those fundamental rights.
Absolutely. And, it's also a great example of how legal precedents, those decisions from higher courts, they have this ripple effect, influencing countless other cases,
Yes.
shaping how laws are interpreted.
It's like each case adds another thread to this, well, this intricate web of legal precedent.
Exactly. And that's why it's so important to stay engaged, understand these cases, to think critically about, how they impact our legal system, our rights, our lives.
So we've delved into the historical context, the dissenting opinions, but there's one more piece of the puzzle, right? Remember that public rights exception?
Oh, yeah, that one's a real head scratcher sometimes.
Well, Grand Financiera, it actually gives us some really valuable insights into the boundaries of that exception. So let's break down this public rights thing a little further. What insights did Grand Financiera offer on this this exception to the jury trial rule?
Well, it's Justice Scalia's concurring opinion that really sheds light on this. He was very, I guess you could say, cautious about expanding this public rights exception too broadly. He argued that it should only apply when the government is a direct party to the lawsuit, not just when there's a matter of like public concern or broad implications. It's got to be the government itself involved.
Oh, okay. So, like, if it's a dispute between two private citizens, even if the issue is something that affects the public, that wouldn't automatically mean no jury trial.
Right. The classic example is like those David versus Goliath scenarios, where someone is challenging a big government agency. That's what Scalia had in mind.
Got it. So things like, I don't know, disputes over Social Security benefits or someone fighting a tax audit, those would fall under public rights.
Yeah, exactly. Or like lawsuits over environmental regulations, things like that. The government's right there in the thick of it.
Makes sense. The Seventh Amendment, it's all about protecting individuals from, well, from the government potentially overstepping its bounds.
Right. So that public rights exception, it's got to stay focused on those situations where the government is a central player. Scalia was basically saying, let's not dilute this exception. Let's keep it focused where it needs to be.
So Grand Financiera, it's not just a lesson in bankruptcy law. It's also a lesson in, well, in the limits of governmental power, how we protect those individual rights. It all ties back to that balance we were talking about earlier.
It all comes full circle, and it shows us that these legal precedents, especially the ones set by the Supreme Court, they have a lasting impact, shaping how other cases are decided, how laws are interpreted, how the whole system functions.
It's like this ongoing conversation, each case adding to the dialogue. So as we wrap up our deep dive into Grand Financiera, what's the one big takeaway you want our listeners to walk away with?
I'd say this. In today's world, things are changing so fast. Technology, the economy, everything. It's more important than ever to make sure our legal system, especially our fundamental rights, can keep up. Grand Financiera reminds us that the Constitution, it's a living document, but it's up to all of us, legal professionals, citizens, everyone, to ensure it stays relevant and protective.
Because those rights, they don't protect themselves. Cases like Grand Financiera, they show us that those rights are constantly being tested, challenged, refined. It's a process we all need to be a part of.
Absolutely. And for anyone listening, I'd say the next time you come across a case, any case, bankruptcy, criminal, whatever, think about the historical context. Ask yourself, would this have gone before a jury back in the day? You might be surprised at what you discover, and you'll gain a deeper appreciation for how our legal system works, how it's evolved, and how those foundational principles, those constitutional rights, they continue to shape our world today.
Well said. And on that note, we're going to wrap up our deep dives into Grand Financiera versus Nordberg. We hope you've enjoyed this exploration with us. And until next time, keep those legal minds engaged.